Unrelentlessly positive.
Innovative.
Innovative?
Innovative. Whatever.
It indicates.
Indicative?
Hey, can we focus?
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome to the 11 o'clock hour of As Goes Wisconsin. I am your host, Kristen Bry, and as always, got Jane Matinere on the board. And this was kind of an accident, but you'd think that it's Farmers Appreciation Day with the guests that we have lined up both for this half hour and the next half hour, because at the bottom of the hour, we are going to be welcoming Brian Reisinger, who is a consultant and a journalist and a columnist who is now writing ongoing series for the Journal Sentinel. And his most recent from yesterday is talking about family farms, including his family farm. And our guest this half hour is also talking about farmers and more specifically, farmers' mental health. So we are joined by Michael Perry, who is an accidental New York Times bestselling author, humorist, singer, songwriter, amateur snowplow driver, and playwright from New Auburn, Wisconsin. And then also Julian Emerson, who is a veteran Wisconsin reporter with most of his work in northwestern part of the state. Welcome, gentlemen. We're so happy to have you.
Glad to be here. Great to be there.
Great to have you. So I guess there is a lot of things that we could talk about because, Michael, reading your bio, you produce a lot. You put a lot of work out into the world between your writing and your radio show and your being a humorist. And I think there's a PBS special I saw that's out right now. But more specifically, especially with Julian being here, having covered a lot of farmers' mental health issues, I wanted to talk about your newest novella, 40 Acres Deep, which is fiction, which is not reporting and it's not a memoir, but it's based on the very real topic of farmers' mental health. And so I guess to just start there, what is the plot of 40 Acres Deep, Michael?
Well, it grew out of the fact that a few winters back, I live on a farm. I am not a farmer. I was raised on a farm. I grew up milking cows and baling hay. I worked for 5 years on a ranch in Wyoming, but I very accidentally wound up being a writer. I have soft hands. I want to lay that out early so that I don't come off as trying to pretend that somehow I'm living the farm life. But I do live on an old farm. And a couple of winters back, we had so much intense snow, it just kept stacking up and stacking up. And I have two old pole barns that I use for storage, and they were in danger of collapsing. And so I was going back and forth between them, desperately trying to keep them from falling in. And it was 2 a.m. I was frustrated and sweaty and angry. And it just stopped for a moment and suddenly realized, you know, I'm a writer with a couple of pole barns full of probably 80% junk. And if the barns go down, well, so it goes. But all around me and throughout this state are people whose entire livelihoods are in buildings like that. And indeed, that winter, many, many buildings went down. And not just buildings were lost, but cattle and, in a couple of cases, lives. And so that was the seed of it. I just was trying to put myself in the place of someone fighting to save not only their building, but then I extrapolated from that into a way of life. And so then over the next couple of years, I cogitated the idea. I had this idea of it just being a very short story, and then it grew a little longer. And then I've never written anything in the novella form, which is, I understand it is defined as longer than a short story, but shorter than a novel. And it just seemed to fit that particular format. And so that's where it all began. And then the rest of it is just, it's fiction. I made it up, but it's definitely drawn partially on my own experience, but even more so from living with, growing up with, and being neighbors with, even now, folks who are living out that very story.
And that is, you know, we've talked about farmers' mental health on the show before with Pom Yonke from Midwest Farmers Report. And, you know, I feel like every couple of months there'll be some headline in one of the Wisconsin newspapers about the crisis, right? The crisis of farmers' mental health and suicide rates. But I feel like there's a different power that happens through narrative, whether it's a play, whether it's a movie, whether it's a novel or a novella, of putting a character's inner thoughts that's different than what you're going to see when you read a report. Even though so much reporting starts with a story of a real person, there's something that is so much more intimate about that kind of descriptive storytelling, or can be. It's different, but it's there. And so is that, do you think there's some power to that as far as you being able to flesh out an entire character's story that other farmers can relate to?
I hope so. There are two things that happen when you're writing fiction, and most of the time I write nonfiction, a lot of memoir. But when you're writing fiction, number one, yes, you do get drawn into the individual story. You're hearing their inner monologues. You're getting the backstory. And by the way, this is an unrelenting book. I have a warning in the beginning, you know, just for folks to know what they're getting into, and they can decide if they want to proceed. There's also humor. There's that kind of dark humor I was raised on as a blue collar farm kid when things went wrong and you didn't have any other option but to plow forward. But yes, I would hope that the fictionalization of it draws you into the character. The other thing that writing in fiction does, at least for me personally, when I write memoir, I write from the heart. I try to be honest. I try to portray things as they are. But of course, there are times when you frame things a certain way because you don't want to get personal. Whereas in this particular novella, I was ruthless with those parts of myself I was drawing on for the character. And I've been caught off guard by the number of emails. I get lots of correspondence from farmers, men and women who are fighting this struggle. But I've been surprised at how many husbands I've heard from who said that this forced them to look in the mirror. And so, yes, I think fiction gives you a certain freedom to be unsparing.
Absolutely.
And again, I didn't want to write a story that somehow put a happy ribbon on it all. I'm not into darkness or perpetuating darkness, but I also wanted to try to be true to the pain that folks are feeling out there.
Absolutely. Now, Julian, you are a reporter and you have talked to lots of farmers and covered their stories from a reporting lens. And so what have you heard, and like, what are some of the stories that you've written about over the couple years when it comes to mental health for farmers?
Well, hey, Kristen, and there's a great irony here that I'm sitting here in the middle of a college campus and somehow got kicked off of the meeting and can't connect. And Mike, I believe, is out in his rural Fall Creek home and can connect. I'm not sure what that says about our Wi-Fi connection here at UW-River Falls. And so I haven't written lots of stories about this topic, honestly. It's mostly a lot of conversations I've had, especially over the last 5 or so years, with farmers I've known. And I've written a bit about it in the last couple of years. But Mike's book really struck a chord with me because it's so much echoed the sentiments that I've heard from real people, even though his character in the book Harold is a fictional character. It's so much Harold's struggles, while they're his own, so much mirrored in a more broad way, the struggles that I've heard from many of the farmers and other rural folks that I'd spoken with in recent years about their struggles. And there were just people reaching out to me saying, hey, there's this, you know, this tragic situation with one of my farmer friends here, and I think maybe it's worth you writing a story about. And honestly, I wish I would have hopped on that story bandwagon earlier, because there are some amazingly powerful stories to tell about the struggles these folks face, and the valiant efforts that a lot of them are putting forth to try and continue farming, especially some of the smaller family farms, when all of the scales of economy are against them.
Absolutely. Our guests this half hour are Michael Perry, who is a New York Times bestselling author, and his newest novella is called 40 Acres Deep, along with Julian Emerson, who is a veteran Wisconsin reporter. And we're talking about the topic of farmers' mental health. Both, I mean, obviously we all live in Wisconsin and that is the stories that we're hearing. And I guess for, and as Michael, you just said that there's a lot of people who've reached out to you since the book's been published and people who've read it. Did you do much research or talk to many people beforehand? Or is this sort of a story that, even though you're not a farmer, that kind of came out of you?
Well, of course, it starts with my childhood. I came of age in the 70s and 80s on a small Wisconsin dairy farm. So from 19—well, actually, I moved there in 66, but I was 2 years old. But I grew up through the 70s and into the early 80s on farms. And if you know our history, a ton of farms went down in the 80s. And so it started with that. But then when it came time to actually write the book, the one thing I did that I don't normally do, normally I work with an editor and some copy editors, but I pretty much just keep a tight lid on things until the book is ready. In this case, I did actually send it out to a few farmers, to a couple of people who work in ag mental health. And the main thing I wanted to do there was to make sure that I got it right or close to right. I didn't want to have some small thing in there that really betrayed the rest of the story, a false note, if you will. So I did in this case send it out. And I also sent it to the farmer specifically because it is a very unrelenting and difficult story. I wanted to know, is there any point to this? And I was surprised that universally each person said, no, this is a hard story. And yes, we do want you to tell it this way.
Ah, that's so, it was so good to hear as far as like the reflection, seeing your story reflected in a way that is hopefully valuable and useful for more people. We're coming up against a break now, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about, because there's a lot of different demographics that are struggling with mental health. We hear about teenagers. We hear about, obviously, their mental health is wrapped up in the opioid epidemic. And talking about what is unique about the farmer's experience right now that is leading to, that is different, that needs a different considerations when we try to talk about solutions to it. So when we come back, we'll talk about that. Again, our guests are Michael Perry, who is a New York Times bestselling author and author of the new book, 40 Acres Deep, along with Julian Emerson, veteran Wisconsin reporter. We're going to take a short break and be right back. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Better about a hard-earned dollar. Just tell him how far he's got to go, and he'll go farther. Here's to the farmer. Here's to the farmer. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And our guests this half hour are Michael Perry, New York Times bestselling author, and Julian Emerson, veteran Wisconsin reporter. And Michael, my mom literally just texted me. so glad to hear Michael Perry. I first became aware of his work when he came to our public library to talk about his book, Population 45. Have been a fan since. So whenever you stopped in Wisconsin Rapids Public Library, my mom was there.
Well, that's extra special because I was actually born in Wisconsin Rapids.
Were you really?
My dad. Yeah, my dad worked in the paper mills over there in Port Edwards, and we had a little home in Nacoosa. And I was born in Wisconsin Rapids, but when I was 2 years old, Dad switched careers and bought a farm up in Chippewa County, Wisconsin, north of New Auburn, Wisconsin. And that's where I lived when I wrote the book, Population 45.
Oh, my gosh. That is, well, small Wisconsin, as they like to say. But yeah, no, my parents still, they were raised there. They still live there. So shout out to WFHR. But the topic we're talking about is farmers' mental health, your new book, 40 Acres Deep, the reporting Julian has done. And so I guess, as I set this up before the break, but there's multiple demographics that are we're talking about mental health with. And I think each one deserves different considerations when we talk about how to approach it. Teenagers and farmers are very different, even though both are going through mental health crises. And so I guess when we talk about what unique considerations and solutions there are when we talk about rural mental health, And this is a question for both of you. What's out there? What seems to work? What seems to be a different approach that is more applicable for farmers? And because it's very, you know, it's also, I have to imagine, lonely, because you're spread out. Like, that is part of the case of living in rural areas, is there's community kind of, but you're also a big plot of land by yourself, right?
Yeah, I'll speak in generalities, and then maybe Julian has some specifics. I am going to be speaking at an event coming up fairly soon about farmers and mental health. There will be someone there who's actually professionally trained to guide the discussion. And I don't have the dates right in front of me. If you go to sneezingcow.com and go to the events page, you'll find it. But speaking generally, I have to say that it's this balance between, I was raised by loggers and truckers and farmers, and there's a certain stoicism and loneliness to each of those professions. And I'm going to tell you that I'm someone who still clings to some of that stoicism, and I'm happiest often when I'm alone. So the upside of that is there's a certain strength in that, but it also can leave you marooned on your own little island of misery. And the one thing I have seen that's changed is that I know loggers, and I'm not just speaking generally. I'm thinking of someone in particular, who a logger who has panic attacks and anxiety issues. And he's been getting therapy, and it's helping him. And he's still rough as a cob, and he still can smash me in an arm wrestling contest. And you don't want me fixing your chainsaw. You want him to do it. But there's just a general acceptance. And I have a background in fire and EMS as well. And I remember when they started bringing in critical incident stress debriefing after really bad calls. And I just talked to a friend this weekend who was at a conference in Wyoming of law enforcement officers and mental health and the importance of these things. So, you know, we're a long way from fixing anything, but I think it's at least become a topic of acceptable discussion.
Absolutely. Julian, have you heard of anything else that you feel like people are trying or that's working?
A bit, you know, like I would, yeah, everything Mike said there is right on. You know, I grew up much of my childhood, my early part of my childhood was actually in the Twin Cities, and in a city in Iowa as well. But then I grew up most of my childhood in very rural, Trumbull and Buffalo County. Actually lived in a log cabin for several years with no electricity. My dad was logged and logged with horses and definitely liked his solitude. I'm very different. I need to be surrounded by people most of the time, right? But when you live in rural areas, you definitely are on your own a lot in those kinds of professions. And there's a real, like, you know, kind of tough, rugged independence of a lot of the folks who live in rural areas. And it's only in recent times, and it's still a stereotype to break down, I think. It's only in recent times that a lot of, you know, tough guy men are willing to acknowledge our mental health issues and willing to get to a point where we're willing to seek counseling. I know numerous people, many, many, many people who have gotten to that point and sought counseling and been able to access counseling. Like, that's a whole other discussion we could have about the lack of access to mental health services. But if, you know, people who have been able to get that counseling and are doing much better because of it, I count myself among those people. So the more of that we can do for society, the better. There are I've written some about this, and there's more to be written and more to be thought about, but. There are different agricultural groups in the state of Wisconsin, DATCAP, at the state level, among them, who recognize what a big issue rural mental health is, what a big issue farmers' mental health is. And there are various initiatives they were able to use some of the ARPA funding for to increase counseling in various areas. I've also, some of my farmer friends have also told me about support groups that they are starting to organize amongst some of their neighbors and the other farmers in their areas, where they can just get together maybe once a week over coffee, or sometimes they'll, you know, bring even over dinner, and they'll sit down and meet down at the local town hall or the fire station or whatever they have, or church, and they'll just talk about the issues they're facing. And there's just to know that there are other folks out there who are struggling like you, and to know that to get affirmation and a sense of support, sometimes just from those folks is enough to help people keep their heads above water. The thing with these farmers is that so much of what they're doing, so much of their income or their very livelihood and their very way of life depends upon so much it's out beyond their control.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I have to, we're coming up against a break, so I have to cut you off. But this was such an incredible discussion. I was so happy to have you both on the show today. Michael Perry, Julian Emerson, thank you so much. Hope to have you both back on soon.
Well, the farmer prayed for a better year, and the crops were good like the Lord did here.
Hey there.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinair, and we are rolling through our Farmer Appreciation Day unplanned until I literally looked this morning as I was planning for the show. I knew that Michael Perry and Julian were on. I knew Brian was on. But what I didn't know was that in Brian's most recent column for the Journal Sentinel, he quoted Michael Perry. And so it's really one coincidence for today. But I'm so happy to have our next guest, Brian Reisinger, who is a writer, consultant, columnist, farm boy, writing about rural issues, the economy, and more for Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he and I also host a new co-host, a new monthly video series called Get to the Point. But we'll talk about that more later. Welcome to As Goes Wisconsin, Brian.
Thanks so much for having me. And thanks for that Johnny Cash lead. And I couldn't ask for anything better than following Michael Perry and Julian and getting brought in by Johnny Cash. So this is going great. I could screw up the rest of this and we'll be good.
Since we started on a good foot, we can only go down from here.
Exactly.
So your most recent Journal Sentinel column was published yesterday. So we're going to get to that. But before we do, I want to get into more like why write these. You have a political background. You're a successful communications consultant. What's the driving force to add another thing on your plate right now? To be writing long form columns about rural life in Wisconsin.
Well, farm boys got to have something to do at 5 a.m. So that's part of it.
You never grew out of that habit.
Yeah. It just doesn't go anywhere, you know, and my wife just knows I'm better when I'm busy. So that's part of it. But the thing that really drives it is, you know, you want to do something meaningful with your time. And growing up where I did, you know, to be honest, I didn't have as much talent for cattle and tractors as my dad and my sister did. And so while I still help out when I'm home, they'll still stick me in a tractor when I'm home for Memorial Day weekend and stuff like that. I had a career off the farm. And as I did that, I found that the things that were most appealing to me, whether it was in journalism, whether it was in government and public policy, or whether it was in consulting, is when I felt like I was doing something for rural Wisconsin or rural America. And so, this is a chance to kind of draw on that. And the through line for me and all the work that I've done has always been writing, whether it's journalism or whatever else it's been. And so getting the chance to do this is really great. And I guess I was just glad that the Journal Sentinel wanted to have a home for this kind of writing, these kinds of stories. You know, the reality is that there are so many news deserts out there. There are so many places that just aren't covered by traditional media anymore. And that's not a critique of the media, although we could spend time critiquing the media if we want to. It's just a function of the fact that there are so many people who live in places where the media isn't able to reach out into those areas as much anymore. So it's one of the many reasons we all have bubbles that are forming around us, right? And the Journal Sentinel wanted to give me a home to tell stories that I've been telling in Newsweek and outdoor magazines and other places. And I was happy to take them up on it. And it's just something that I've been doing more of in the last couple of years. And I'm really glad to maybe try to break all of our bubbles, my own included. And so it's just a meaningful thing because it allows me to combine kind of where I'm from with what my work has been for the last 20 years or so. And so I get a lot out of it. But it also just keeps me busy. So
absolutely. So the most recent article is called Fighting a Fire and Odds Against Survival for Wisconsin Family Farms. So this is part personal and talking about a fire that happened on your family farm, but it also talking about the bigger issue. And, you know, in the previous segment, we were talking about mental health, which obviously plays into this. But what we didn't touch on there, which I think your article does a lot, is just the stress and the sometimes unsurmountable obstacles of being a small family farm in this day and age, and what the financial stresses are, what the, you know, legacy of passing it on and having your kids and pivoting business models and stuff. So I guess in what you know personally, what you wrote about for this article, like what kind of is the state of Wisconsin family farms right now?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. There's a lot of pride and there's a lot of resilience wrapped up in that. So I don't want tough to only be a negative word, but there is an element to this that you just can't get around. And I think a lot of people maybe want to remember farms fondly and kind of let it be that. And I think that we have to stare this in the face a little bit more. And so, and that includes people that are from rural areas and not, you know, and I think that when I say tough, it's the economics, it's the social trends, it's all of those things that put farms in a position of being so close to the edge and having such low margins. It's the way that things have changed over the decades. I mean, it's been decades now where basically every year there are fewer farms, and it is, I mean, it's exponential in terms of the number of farms that we've lost. And we still have a really proud tradition here in Wisconsin, and there's a proud tradition in a lot of parts of rural America where there's still a lot of economic activity, including here in Wisconsin, that's driven by farms and by agriculture. But the number of farms has been shrinking for decades now. And those farms that are left are in a tougher spot. And that includes larger farms and smaller farms. One of the biggest changes that we've seen when we talk about that consolidation is the number of medium-sized farms has gone away. So where we're at really now is we have a lot of large farms and we have a number of really small farms that might be more hobby farms, or might be a farm where someone's farming part-time and has a job off the farm as well. Those medium-sized farms that powered a lot of the industry are the ones that have really disappeared. So it's hard, and the pressure isn't letting up. You know, at the same time, you can't only dwell on that partially because there's people still living on these farms and doing this work and succeeding at it too. So it's a real mix, but it's a very difficult picture.
Well, and it's also interesting because we've had Pam Yonke, who is also quoted in your most recent column, saying, you know, it's not like we have any less cows. At least that's what stuck out to me the last time she was on the show, of that people are, it's the number of cows is the same, but the number of farms are going down because people are selling their herds and retiring or pivoting. And so that was really fascinating to me. And so it's, what are some of the different, because I think for those of us who are not farmers, we're totally blind to like, what is the business models that are even available? And like, what are the kind of pivots that like, and options in front of people as they're deciding like the future of our farm and how it could still survive, but look, maybe look different.
Yeah. It's a great question. It's a great point by Pam. And when I did the column and when I do this stuff in general, I try to, like you do with the show, I try to talk to the smartest people that I can find on these issues. And, you know, your current guest is apparently an exception to that rule, but you assemble some really smart people. and what Pam's talking about is a very real thing. The reality is that it's not like the industry is wasting away, right? There are the same number of cows. In fact, same number of cows, more production, some more milk. And that's something that I remember growing up. We had a small, what was then considered maybe medium and pretty quickly became considered small, 50 cow dairy. And we were getting more milk out of every single cow as we went along. And that's true of every farmer, whatever their size is. So we get fewer farms, but just as many cows and more milk production. And so it's really a very strong, resilient industry in that way. But to your point, there's different models and there's a lot of farms disappearing if they don't find a model that can work. And there are some that disappear no matter what they do to try to find a model because of things that they can't control. So the models that we see right now, there's a number of farms that are the bigger farms. Some of them have larger feedlots and things like that. And some of the things that you associate with bigger farms, but some of them are just farms with milking parlors and they might have a couple hundred cows. A couple hundred cows is now kind of a little bit of a smaller size dairy. And so there are people who've made the transition toward having parlors and having like robotic milkers and a little bit more automation on what would still be understood as a traditional family farm, just bigger than it used to be. Mm-hmm. And then there are a number of smaller farms that I say hobby farms or people who have part-time income. You know, they might pour concrete or work at the factory or have another small business on the side, but they also get part of their income from their farm. And those are people who might be experimenting with different types of crops, things like that, trying to figure out how to grow that into a bigger thing. Our farm is in a little bit of a position where we're kind of on that smaller end and we're trying to work out and figure out a way to kind of cover out our own niche with a number of revenue streams. So we have the choice at our farm to either get bigger if we wanted to. Luckily, my parents hadn't taken out a lot of debt. Things were tough because farming is tough, but not because we were in bad shape. And mm-hmm. so we had a choice, you know, and we had to decide, do we want to go from 50 cows to several hundred cows and invest in robotic milkers and a parlor and that kind of thing? Or do we want to go the other direction? And we decided to try to go the other direction. And what we're doing now is we're raising heifers for other larger dairies. So we're kind of a supplier to other dairy farms. And then we raise beef and cash crops. So for us, we're trying to have kind of a multiple revenue stream business model that allows us to hedge against things and do a number of things at once. And there's a lot of smaller farms that are trying to do that kind of thing, or they might be zeroing in on like a specific specialty crop, to try to find, you know, what's that thing that might take off and give new life to smaller farms again, because there has to be something out there. So there's a lot of experimenting going on, but definitely with fewer farms.
Yeah. And besides the sentimentality of it, which I share, I'm not a farmer, but I would say, like, as you write in your column, like, dairy farms are part of Wisconsin's identity, whether or not you've ever even set foot on a dairy farm and being a Wisconsinite, right? And so beyond the nostalgia, the sentimentality, like, what is the economic reason for us to invest and care and talk about saving family farms?
Yeah, there's a Wisconsin answer to that, and there's a national answer, and they're related. The Wisconsin answer to that is that it is such a lifeblood for our rural communities all across the state. And it's true that manufacturing and other types of industry are also really important to rural Wisconsin, but there are whole communities that were built on the strength of the growth in farming at one time. And if we can find a way for small and medium-sized farms and large farms, like farms of all sizes, you have a really diverse mm-hmm. economic situation here in the agriculture industry, if we can find a way to do that, it can breathe new life into entire sections of our state that are fading, with communities that are shrinking and industries that are withering. And so that's the real reason that Wisconsin should focus on it. It was a major engine. It can be again nationwide. It has to do with our entire food system, right? We have a food system that has been good at delivering food cheaply, and it's gotten cheaper and cheaper over years. We've also sacrificed in some cases quality. We've sacrificed in some cases health and our knowledge of where our food comes from and the kinds of things that people are hungering for now more and more. And we can't do that. We can't provide locally sourced food. Farm to table is a great thing, but it's more of a novelty than it is the main way that we get our food. And mm-hmm. so we don't have a diversified food industry, and that puts us in difficult positions, because eventually food gets expensive, right? And the cost of food greatly outpaced inflation last year, when inflation was such a big issue. So this system that's supposed to be delivering cheap food can only do it up to a point. In the meantime, we've sacrificed knowing where our food comes from, health, freshness, diversity of products, all the other things that we lost while we were seeking cheap. So I like cheap food. Mm-hmm. We should have cheap food, but we should also have a diverse industry that can be resilient and not be as vulnerable to disease or all the other things that, look at our food system, how it was teetering during COVID, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's a bigger reason for all of us to want to do this, in addition to caring about Wisconsin.
Our guest is Brian Reisinger, who is a columnist, consultant, and farm boy. And we're talking about his series for Journal Sentinel, most recently his one about farms. And so there was the one that kind of talked about the loss of Wisconsin farms, but then you also published five factors that can help save Wisconsin family farms. So we only have a couple minutes before the break, so we can start talking about those five factors and finish it on the other side. But what are some of the reasons for hope, or the things that we should be looking at when it comes to saving and investing in family farms?
Yeah, absolutely. I have to be careful. My wife says I'll get too deep into the sad farm boy stuff, so I'm glad you asked about that. awareness is big, and people who care about where their food comes from, which there's more of that than ever. You know, people who go to farmers markets, people who go to restaurants that are farm to table, that kind of thing. There's more of that than ever. So that's great. But what we really need to do is we need to get a whole new era of innovation in American agriculture. And that is, it's not just a government program, and it's not just like a vague idea. It's the entire economic ecosystem. So back when Wisconsin became the dairy state, we were mixed agriculture in the early 1900s. And the way we became dairy is because farmers on the individual basis, small businesses in the private sector, were experimenting with all kinds of different crops and products, trying to figure out what could make them enough of a profit. We also had a university system that was investing, and we also had government and large, you know, private sector players that were all investing in research and development to figure out what that could be. So what we need to do is we need to find, what's that next dynamo? What's that next thing that's going to be, you know, the source to let us rise from the ashes?
All right, there's four other factors, but we're going to get to those after the break. Our guest is Brian Reisinger. This is As Goes Wisconsin, and we'll be right back.
Women will look back, and it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, there's a lot of difference in window shopping and shoplifting. I sat down at a shoe shine stand. I had a real slow shoe shine man. I said, you don't pop that rag like some of them can. He looked at me and then he said right back, it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, the trouble with the world today is there's too much popping and not enough shine.
I won't just survive. Oh, you will see me thrive. Can write my story. I'm beyond the archetype. I won't just
conform. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. Jane Manier, was that Evanescence? What are we listening to?
That is Katy Perry, Rise.
It was just associated with the farmers?
It's about resilience and coming back and surviving and fighting on for another day to fight.
All right, I got it. I see the connection, Jane. Good job. Our guest for this half hour is Brian Reisinger, and we were talking about his latest column for the Journal Sentinel on farmers and farming, since he grew up on a farm in Sauk County. And we are touching on the more positive aspects of the things. You had two that were published yesterday, and one was about kind of the sad parts, and one was about the things that we can look forward to. And so you were saying before the break, innovation is one of the factors that can help save Wisconsin family farms. What are the other four?
Technology is related to innovation, but it's a good example. For a long time, farm technology has been about like how many more rows can you add to the planter, right? Like how big of a field can you do? But there's also opportunity for technology that can help small farms be able to be more economical. They don't just have to be the kind of technology that means you don't need labor and you can be bigger, but also that can help those farms that are really small businesses. So robotic milkers, self-driven machines in the fields that can do pesticides and things like that. Moving beyond that stuff, obviously government policy plays a huge role in the agriculture industry. We should do a whole show on that. But there's opportunity for investment and research development when it comes to the farm bill. There's an opportunity to make sure that the programs are responsive to the needs of farmers in that as well. And you know, the other things that I think are really important to remember are just the things that we can do in our communities. And so the reality is that thinking about where your food comes from and the difference that each consumer can make along the way. But there's also just paying attention to issues like mental health. We want to have an agriculture industry that's healthy, that has people wanting to come into it, that is inspiring to people. And there's a real mental health issue right now. And that means people being willing to talk about it. And that means people reaching out when they need help. There's a lot of weight. There's a lot of pride, but there's a lot of weight that comes with growing up in a farm family. And Michael Perry talked about this when I talked to him for the column, and he talks about it really, really artfully, where, you know, he knows that everybody's situation is different, but he talks about the fact that, you know, the thing with farm families is get out there and get the chores done, you know, go do your job, do your work, keep your nose to the grindstone. And that doesn't always leave a lot of room to talk about like how you're feeling along the way. And I even feel a little funny saying it, you know, it's just like, well, what am I talking about? And we can't do that. We got to push past that and kind of stare it in the face. So.
Because both can exist. Yeah. You can get the work done, but also have feelings about it.
Yes. And I'm sorry to go mental health and bring it down from Jane's inspiring take on Evanescence. I felt the uplift. I promise.
So as someone who straddles or who has straddled both coming from a farm, but then, as you said, not having the aptitude necessarily to stay on the farm and finding a career somewhere else. So you straddle the two worlds of kind of what I'm sure, not insular, but, you know, it's farmers know farming and a lot of them don't necessarily leave. And so some of the stuff that you and I do is leaving and writing and working in campaigns and stuff like that feels very foreign versus like I said, even with the most sentimentality and like nostalgia and reverence for farmers, I don't understand what it's like to be a farmer. So as someone who can kind of see both worlds, like, what is it that the average person who never sets foot on a farm, except maybe once for content, doesn't get, yeah, no matter how much we read your articles or headlines or whatever?
Yeah, I think the big thing is understanding what it means when you say that farming is not just a job, it's a way of life. And people say it, and I appreciate when people say it, but it sometimes chafes people when it's said by people who don't understand it. And I think we got to push past those things and learn more about what it means. But what it means to rural areas, and why I do appreciate when people say it, is because they're trying to understand how significant it is. It's just hard to do if you haven't grown up on a farm. So what we mean by it is, like, okay, so my dad's job was farming, but it was also my mom's job. And it was also my first job and my second job and my third job, right? And it's also our house, but it's also our community, because we don't live in town. We have neighbors who probably help with the harvest, and, you know, we do business together. And so that's our community too, if those farms are disappearing. And then it's our heritage. It goes all the way back, in our case, to over 100 years ago, when our great grandparents came over from Bavaria and found a spot in a little valley to get their start. So what it means when we say it's a way of life, imagine if your dad's job, your mom's job, your first job, and maybe your next couple of jobs, and your home, and everyone you grew up with, and all your neighbors, and your heritage all tied back. That's what that means. And so everybody has their version of that, but for a lot of people, that comes from a lot of different places, you know? And in farms, it's all tied up in that one piece of land. And that's why it's so significant. That's why it's so meaningful, and there's so much joy, and that's also why it has so much weight to it.
I'm not sure many of, it's not like you're 9 to 5, I'll just quit this and move on to the next thing if it doesn't work out, and right, jump for a higher salary. It's not quite the same level of gravity.
Yeah.
And so that's really interesting to think about. And so, well, this went way too quickly. And so I was, we were going to talk about your other article, which people should certainly go read, which is about the drug crisis that's happening in rural Wisconsin through the lens of a friend that you grew up with. But also, just to end on as a short plug for our show, Get to the Point, which is once a month on Journal Sentinel, where if you could, because we didn't really talk about politics at all today,
right,
but we approach that show from kind of a center right, center left, different topics. And so we'll have to have you back to have a little bit more conversation around how to have political conversations with people who see the world a little differently than you. Cause it has been very fun to do that. Have we done 4 of them so far? 3?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. Time flies when you're having fun. They've been great. And it is, I mean, there's a way to have these conversations, and it can be fun, and it can be unexpected. And I think one of the big things that has been a takeaway for me is seeing how people don't fit into boxes. And you kind of know that when you talk to people, but when you start talking politics, it feels like people do fall into boxes. And I think that people really don't. Even the most liberal and most conservative people that I know, whether they're from rural areas or not, they have such a wide range of views. It depends upon what issue you're talking about. And you can find a curveball in anybody's arsenal. And that's what I think has been fun about this. And I think that's the kind of thing that we need to do more of in our public discourse, to use a high-minded phrase.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we will absolutely have to have you back on the show. We have only scratched the surface, but go follow him. Go read his article that came out yesterday in Journal Sentinel. Brian Risinger, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
All right. Well, that'll about do it for us today. Tomorrow, Greg Bach will be back on the show. And for everyone who called in, everyone who texted in, if you're on the live stream, thank you for being part of the show. We will do it all again tomorrow at 10 a.m. This has been As Goes Wisconsin.